Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley, brought to you from Hyatt Ricky's in Palo Alto, California. I'm Gloria Duffy, CEO of the club, and your chair for today. We would like to welcome the listeners of KMTT-FM 103.7 in Seattle, one of the 225 stations joining us nationwide for America's longest-running radio program. When experts and diplomats talk today about the security challenges of greatest concern to the U.S. and the international community, Asia and the Pacific Basin quickly rise to the top of the list. In a region where a number of troubled relationships exist, India and Pakistan, North and South Korea, for example, the relationship between China and Taiwan has in recent months become one of the more uneven. You all know, of course, that our speaker today, Dr. William Perry, served with great distinction as U.S. Secretary of Defense from 1994 to 1997. In that role, he was a strong leader for the Department of Defense and for the administration as a whole, who effectively addressed the toughest problems for U.S. security: the renegotiation of the U.S. Security Treaty with Japan, the removal and destruction of thousands of nuclear weapons in the former Soviet Union that posed a proliferation threat to the U.S. and other countries, the closure and conversion of many U.S. military bases, upgrading the quality of life for U.S. servicemen and women, introducing standards of business management and procurement into the world's largest organization, the Department of Defense. He is the recipient of many honors and awards, including the Defense Department Distinguished Service Medal and the Presidential Medal of Freedom. You may also know that Dr. Perry is a scientist, a mathematician, in fact, an entrepreneur and Silicon Valley pioneer who founded and for many years headed ESL Corporation, a scholar who is revered both at Stanford University, where he's on the faculty, and throughout the field of defense and security studies, an early investor in the high-tech revolution in the 1980s when he was with Hambrecht and Quist, and now a board member of several technology startup companies. But Dr. Perry's role and influence on international politics did not end when he left the Department of Defense. In U.S. foreign and security policy, there are some things that the U.S. government can do directly and some things that, because of their sensitivity, cannot easily be done by a sitting government. Since he left his post as Secretary of Defense, Bill Perry has played a unique and highly valuable role. As a private citizen, but often at the request of the President, Dr. Perry has continued to tackle our country's major security challenges, bringing to bear the positive relationships he formed with foreign leaders while in government, his intellect and personal force, and a way of thinking which he calls preventive defense, which seeks to address security challenges through creative strategies before they emerge as threats requiring military responses. In this manner, as coordinator of U.S. policy towards North Korea, over the past 2 years, Dr. Perry engaged in talks with North Korea and governments of contiguous countries in a way which not only forestalled the North Korean nuclear weapons program, but set the stage for the opening we currently see between the North Korean and South Korean governments. More recently, he has been devoting some of his energy to the relationship between China and Taiwan, which he will discuss today. Finally, on a personal note, Dr. Perry universally inspires those who have the privilege to work with him, and I am one of those lucky people who've had that opportunity. He works with others with a combination of grace, respect, and demand for the best that others have to give. I still remember the time in the Pentagon when we made a presentation to Secretary Perry summarizing our accomplishments on a project up to a line drawn across a page under which were listed the future goals to be reached. Dr. Perry's one comment was, "Great, now what about the items below the line?" He always gives 1,000% of his own energy and resources. He pushes for the best and gets it from others. Please welcome one of our region's and the world's most distinguished citizens, Dr. William Perry.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Gloria, for that warm introduction. We have been experiencing for the last few decades a true phenomenon, which is the Asian economic miracle. Everyone in Silicon Valley has in some way benefited from this economic miracle and in many ways have contributed to it. But this economic miracle has occurred within a security environment. And the environment basically was that there has been security and stability in the region for the last two decades. And that security and stability permitted this economic miracle to occur. Where did we get this security and stability? We have no NATO. We have no security institution, anything like NATO, in the region. And the answer simply was it was the American security strategy. Let me briefly summarize for you the three key components of this strategy, the first of which was we have had bilateral treaties in the region, primarily with Korea, South Korea, Japan, and Australia. They have been attended by a forward deployment of more than 100,000 American military forces. As we sit here today, 100,000 of our military forces are deployed in the Western Pacific. Secondly, it's been Americans' actions in conjunction with its allies to prevent the spread of nuclear weapons in the region. And then finally, America's engagement with the People's Republic of China based on the One China policy. Well, the good news is that this strategy has worked very well and the region has prospered. The bad news is the profound events, some of them not under the control of the United States, are undermining this strategy. So today I will highlight those undermining forces, forces that could lead to conflict in the region. And I'll give special emphasis to the U.S.-China relations. Now, the first major concern with our past security strategy is that our efforts to prevent nuclear proliferation, which have been incredibly successful for many decades now, are now under serious stress. For most of the last few decades, nuclear weapons have played no explicit role in the region's security. But in the last few years, this has changed. And the only question now is how far and how extensive the changes will be. India and Pakistan have now tested nuclear weapons and have declared themselves to be nuclear nations. They have underway programs to adapt this nuclear capability to delivery systems, including long-range ballistic missiles. And they're planned to produce these weapons in some quantity. I believe it is only a matter of time until they deploy nuclear-tipped ballistic missiles. And I believe that this greatly increases the danger that these weapons will be used, either in anger or through a failure of command and control. There's another example of proliferation in Asia, one that could be even more dangerous. 6 years ago, the North Korea nuclear facility at a small town called Yongbyon was about to begin processing nuclear fuel. And this would have provided them with enough plutonium to make about a half a dozen nuclear bombs. This led to a crisis that came very close to military conflict, much closer than most citizens realize. But it was resolved instead by a diplomatic agreement known as the Agreed Framework. Then 2 years ago, the crisis flared up again with North Korea's test firing of long-range missiles over Japan. In response to this crisis, the President asked me to work in conjunction with the Republic of Korea and Japan to formulate a new security policy with respect to North Korea. This study reached its culmination about a year ago in a trip we made to Pyongyang, during which we offered the North Korean government a path towards normal relations if they were willing to give up their long-range missiles as well as their nuclear weapons. A number of meetings have followed since then. The first two in Beijing and Geneva were not conclusive. At a third meeting in Berlin, the first positive step was taken. They agreed to suspend missile testing, and we agreed to lift sanctions on consumer products. We both agreed to establish high-level talks on the proposal that we had given them in Pyongyang. In the meantime, the Japanese government and the South Korean government have been pursuing parallel but closely coordinated paths to achieve our joint objectives. The Japanese have already had two separate meetings with the North Koreans, one in Pyongyang and one in Tokyo. Most significantly, the South Koreans have had a real breakthrough in their approach to the North. Early this year, they held a series of secret talks with the North Koreans in Beijing, which resulted in an agreement for a first-ever summit meeting between their two countries. That meeting, as you know, was held last month. South Korean and American government officials had modest expectations for that meeting. The mere fact of holding it was in itself an historic achievement. But in fact, the results exceeded our expectations. The atmosphere for the talks was exceptionally warm, and modest but quite positive agreements were made on exchange of family visits and the opening of trade. The trade opening itself could lead in time to real change in North Korea. President Kim Dae-jung summed up his reaction to the summit meeting by stating that South Koreans no longer needed live under the constant threat of an imminent war. So I am pleased with the real progress that has been made by all three allies to this point. But I'm also clear that much more remains to be done. Each step of the negotiations ahead of us could be frustrating and difficult. We cannot be confident of a positive outcome. So I have recommended that we make no reductions in our military deployments in Korea or in the readiness of our backup forces. That is, I told President Clinton that we should keep our powder dry. But I also told him that we should negotiate creatively and tenaciously to create the maximum chance for success. For if we are unsuccessful in persuading North Korea to remove the threat, we must take actions that are even more difficult. We must take actions to contain the threat. I believe that I understand better than most the risks and the costs associated with containment. And as a result of that understanding, I am reluctant to recommend threat containment. But if required, the Allies must be prepared to take that step. A second development that could upset the security and stability in the region is that the engagement between the United States and China could revert to confrontation. Today, China is rising as an economic, as a military, and as a political power in the Pacific, and that has led to areas of confrontation with the other great Pacific powers, United States and Japan. The flashpoint, of course, in U.S.-China relations is Taiwan. Just how dangerous this flashpoint can be was demonstrated during the 1996 presidential elections in Taiwan, when Chinese military forces conducted extensive exercises apparently with the intention of putting pressure on Taiwan. This pressure culminated in March of 1996, a few weeks before the Taiwan elections, with a series of live missile firings, which impacted just a few tens of miles from Taiwan. The United States believed that this action violated the no use of force aspect of the One China policy and was a threat to the stability of the entire region. As a consequence, President Clinton authorized me to send two carrier battle groups to Taiwan. Now, most of you probably do not appreciate the significance of two carrier battle groups. You might think of it as two ships, but two carrier battle groups are a mighty fleet. And indeed, those two carrier battle groups together are a more powerful naval force than any other navy in the entire world, certainly including the Chinese Navy. So this was a very powerful symbolic gesture we were making, sending those two carrier battle groups to Taiwan. Well, the crisis passed with no incident between American and Chinese military forces, and by the end of 1996, engagement was underway again. Then last year, a whole series of incidents occurred which caused another major setback to engagement. Premier Zhu Rongji, in his visit to Washington, had expected to get an agreement on Chinese membership in the World Trade Organization, but but went home empty-handed. This clearly reduced his influence in China, him and his reformist supporters, and as a consequence set back engagement, even after the eventual U.S. agreement. Premier Zhu's visit was followed by the accidental bombing of the Chinese embassy in Belgrade. This incident is made even more serious because Chinese government officials believe that the bombing was deliberate. During this same period, the American Congress made public a report that accused the Chinese government of conducting a systematic and extensive program to steal military secrets from the United States. Then the president of Taiwan, Li Dongwei, stated that the relations between China and Taiwan should be relations as between two states. The Chinese, regarding this as a virtual declaration of independence, immediately responded by cutting off the cross-strait talks, the cross-strait dialogue, which they had been conducting with Taiwan. Well, last March, Taiwan conducted another presidential election, just 4 years after the March 96 election, which had caused all the excitement. This time, China did not resort to missile firings, but rather tried to intimidate by inflammatory rhetoric, apparently trying to discourage the Taiwanese from electing Chen Shui-bian, the candidate of the Democratic Progressive Party, which had advocated independence. However, it appears that this rhetoric backfired, since Mr. Chen, who was trailing James Sung when the rhetoric started, was elected finally with a 3% plurality. Well, it is too early to forecast the actions of either the Chinese government or the new administration in Taiwan, but I fear that the situation could lead to a crisis more dangerous than previous crises. With this concern in mind, I went to Taipei a few weeks ago to meet with President Chen Shui-bian and his key cabinet officers, followed by a meeting in Beijing with the Chinese Minister of Defense. I wanted to explore whether it was possible to get the cross-strait dialogue going again. The good news is that Chen Shui-bian has backed off his earlier statements of seeking a referendum for independence and is sincerely seeking to renew the cross-strait talks with the People's Republic of China. The bad news is that China has reacted with suspicion and has stated that they are not willing to resume the talks unless Taiwan first agrees to the One China principle. Taiwan, not unreasonably, has argued that this should be the subject of the talks, not a condition for the talks. And so the situation remains stalled. And my fear is that the events which unstall it may all be negative. Shortly after the 1996 crisis, the PLA stated that their new strategy will be to increase their offensive military capability, that is, their ability to project military power beyond their borders. It is not hard to imagine that the motivation for this new strategy is to achieve a credible capability to put military pressure on Taiwan. One consequence of this new strategy was China making substantial purchases from Russia of modern offensive weapons, including high-performance, long-range fighter aircraft. Another consequence of this strategy has been the buildup of Chinese missile forces directly across the strait from Taiwan. In response to this threat, Taiwan has requested that the United States supply them with additional military equipment, including Aegis cruisers and missile defense systems. The United States has not yet made a decision on this request, and China has stated that the deployment of missile defenses would spark an arms race in the region. Well, I share the Chinese concern over the deleterious effect of an arms race in the region, but I believe that if such an arms race does get underway, it will have been stimulated by their extensive deployment of missiles, not the deployment of missile defenses. And I've suggested to my Chinese interlocutors that the best way to avoid such an arms race is for China to declare a moratorium on further deployments of missiles that target Taiwan. However, it is clear that they are not taking this advice and are in fact accelerating the deployment of missiles targeted at Taiwan, which in turn adds to the pressure in the United States to supply missile defenses to Taiwan. So we are faced with a situation in which both sides of the strait view the other with suspicion. No dialogue is underway to ease that suspicion, and a dangerous arms buildup is underway. It takes me to my third factor, threatens to undermine stability in the region, and that is the potential deployment by the United States of a national missile defense system. The move to deploy a national missile defense system was given considerable support by the report of the Rumsfeld Commission, which concluded that ICBMs are being developed by three nations hostile to the United States. To deal with this potential ICBM threat, we have, in fact, three lines of defense, which in my order of priority are, first, try to prevent the threat from materializing. Second, if prevention fails, try to deter nations from using these weapons. And third, if both prevention and deterrence fail, be prepared to defend against their use. Now, nearly all of the debate to this point has been on the third line of defense, but I think that it is important to take a broader point of view, and I will try to share that with you today. The first line of defense, one that receives almost no attention, is to prevent the nuclear threat and the ICBM threat from emerging. There are many courses of preventive action open to us. We could sustain and strengthen the bilateral and multilateral treaties and agreements dealing with nuclear weapons, including the Non-Proliferation Treaty, the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, START 2, START 3, the Nunn-Lugar Program. We could strengthen the non-proliferation programs that make it harder for nations to go nuclear or to get long-range missiles. Considering how many nations have sophisticated nuclear or missile technology, it is clear that non-proliferation programs can be successful only when these programs have international support. We cannot conduct them unilaterally. Thus, if our relations with Russia or China become confrontational over the national missile defense deployment, it is less likely that we will get their cooperation in refusing to sell nuclear or missile technology to other nations. It is also less likely that we will get Russia's continued cooperation in the Nunn-Lugar program, which plays an important role in preventing the leakage of nuclear technology, materials, or even weapons to other nations. In addition to pursuing non-proliferation programs, we could practice diplomacy that provides disincentives for proliferation and incentives for non-proliferation. A good example of that is the diplomatic efforts now underway with North Korea. In my judgment, prevention should be our first priority in dealing with this emerging threat, but I would concede that we cannot always count on its success. In North Korea, we have started a promising process, but we are not yet certain of what its final result will be. In Iraq, the United Nations organization, UNSCOM, has curtailed the Iraqi nuclear program for almost a decade, but is losing supporters in the UN. And in Iran, we have hopes that the new reform-minded government will draw that nation back from their programs in nuclear weapons and ICBMs, but the jury is still out. So each of these non-proliferation programs has problems, problems that are significant enough that we should not base our defense posture on the assumption that these non-proliferation programs will succeed. But neither should we base our defense posture on the assumption that they will fail, particularly if that defense posture is likely to provoke reactions that could actually increase the severity of the threats. Thus, I believe we should make prevention our first priority, but if prevention does fail, we can still fall back on deterrence, as we did with the Soviet Union during the Cold War. Some discount whether we can deter nations that they call rogue. In fact, if there's any definition of the term rogue, it is a tautological one. That is, a rogue nation is one that is not deterrable. I will not use the term rogue nation, nor do I believe in its underlying concept, because I am persuaded that the threat of using American conventional military forces is a powerful deterrent, let alone the existential threat that we might respond with our nuclear forces. But I can conceive of situations where a hostile power, for coercive purposes, might threaten to use nuclear weapons against us or against one of our allies. Considering the catastrophic consequences to their own nation, such a threat would likely be a bluff, but a bluff that could get out of control. And in an extreme case, our deterrence could fail if a regime was about to collapse and decided to use nuclear weapons as one last desperate act. Thus, it is not unreasonable, in my judgment, to consider the need for a defensive capability as an insurance policy against the possible failure of the first two lines of defense. But before we buy that policy, we should ask two fundamental questions. Will the insurance be collectible? That is, will the defense work? And secondly, how much does the policy cost, considering both dollar costs and geopolitical costs? I have views on each of these questions, but my talk today will focus on the issue of geopolitical cost, in particular, the geopolitical fallout in U.S.-China relations. There has been much media attention to the probable effect of an NMD, a National Missile Defense deployment, would have on U.S.-Russia relations. But while Russia has had an extremely negative political reaction to an NMD deployment, it is clear that their retaliatory capability would not be as significantly affected by the NMD system planned. The situation with China is different in that their ICBMs could be significantly affected by even the first phase of our planned deployment. For many years, they have had deployed about 20 ICBMs with single warheads, which gives them a minimal but a real deterrent capability. It is likely that they would see our first phase deployment reducing this capability, possibly defeating it. I want to be clear that I do not believe that we owe the People's Republic of China a free shot at our country, or that we should be unduly concerned about whether they are unhappy with our deployment. My concern is much more pragmatic. It is tied to the steps that they are likely to take to restore their deterrence, and whether those steps lead to an increase or a decrease in security for the United States. The most obvious response would be for them to build more launchers or to achieve more warheads through a technique we call MIRVing, putting multiple warheads on one reentry vehicle. The People's Republic of China already has under development a new generation ICBM, presumably to replace their current system and to make it less vulnerable by adding mobility. We do not know what their plans are for this new ICBM, but in the face of a deployment of a national missile defense system, they certainly would have an incentive to build many more of these than are needed for replacement of the older system. They could also carry out a service life extension program on their older system, including the addition of multiple warheads. And they could embark on an aggressive program of countermeasures. In fact, they have already begun a discussion with the Russians about sharing technology in the field of penetration aids of ballistic missile defense systems. Of course, the People's Republic of China could take these actions even if we did not deploy our national missile defense system, and that their decisions on strategic weapons will be affected not only by our national missile defense actions, but also by the political context on which those decisions are made. The desire for reunification with Taiwan influences China's views on all issues, including missile defense. Thus, China's concern about the U.S. deployment of theater or national missile defense systems are intensified by the possibility of military confrontation over Taiwan and by their fear that the United States could be on the side of Taiwan in such a confrontation. So it is possible that China will decide to proceed on this expansion of their strategic missile program irrespective of our actions. But our national missile defense deployment by itself not only gives them considerable incentive to take actions to limit effectiveness, it also undercuts any moves that we might make to limit their missile buildup through agreements on arms control. Of course, if China makes significant additions to its missile forces, these additions could also be seen by India as threatening to them and could result in an additional buildup in the Indian force of nuclear missiles. That, in turn, would be seen by the Pakistanis as threatening to them and could result in additional buildups to their nuclear missiles, with attendant responses in other Mideast nations, including Iraq, Iran, and Israel. Well, I have called out just some of the unintended consequences of a national missile defense deployment by the United States. Thus, a relatively small deployment of defensive systems could have the effect of triggering a regional nuclear arms race of considerable proportions. And such an arms race would create real and obvious dangers for nations in the region, but it could also undermine our own security. I do not believe that this is a worst-case scenario. Indeed, I believe it is the likely consequence in the Asia-Pacific region of a national missile defense deployment, and that this consequence is one important component of the cost of our insurance policy. A worst-case scenario would have to consider also the possibility that Japan would regard the Chinese buildup so menacing that it felt the need to respond with an arms buildup of its own, possibly including nuclear missiles. We need to understand these geopolitical costs in some detail before we can intelligently answer the question, do the costs to our security of deployment outweigh the benefits to our security? In sum, my conclusion is that the American strategy, which for the last few decades has been the key to security and stability in the Asia-Pacific region, is now under great pressure. As a result, I am more pessimistic about the future of U.S.-China relations than I have been for several decades. And I fear that there is a real potential that we will slide into a new nuclear arms race. Thus, I believe that we should put a higher priority on the preventive defense programs that try to head off the ICBM threat from becoming serious. And for success, these programs will require international cooperation, especially from the Russians and the Chinese. I fully understand that this cooperation might not be forthcoming and that we should be prepared to provide for our security. But in light of the stakes, I believe the United States should go the extra mile before we take the actions based on that conclusion. I thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Perry, for that sobering and interesting portrait. One thing I forgot to do when I was doing welcomes earlier was welcome the members of the Consular Corps who are here with us today. From San Francisco, I see Michael Frost from the British Consul, the British Consul General, Mr. Tanaka, the Japanese Consul General, and there may be others here. We're very happy to have you with us today. Now I'd like to turn to Dan Snyder to conduct the question and answer period. Dan is National Foreign Editor of the San Jose Mercury News. Prior to that, he was a Knight Fellow at Stanford University. Prior to that, he was the Bureau Chief in the former Soviet Union for the Christian Science Monitor. And if you read the Mercury News, he is the creator of that very excellent weekly section called The World. Dan Snyder.
Thank you, Gloria. Dr. Perry, we have an enormous number of questions, but let me start with this one. Your successor, Secretary Cohen, said recently in Beijing that the next 6 months would be a window of opportunity for Taipei and Beijing to resume negotiations. Do you share this optimistic observation, and what would be the major obstacle to overcome in resuming negotiations and dialogue between China and Taiwan?
I do believe that the next 6 months are going to be a critical window of opportunity for renewing those negotiations because, for the reasons I gave in my speech, I can see other events pushing things downhill. So it's very important to get that dialogue started again. I think the greatest barrier to the dialogue right now is the mutual suspicion on both sides, and that was my very strong impression having just visited Taipei and Beijing recently. The United States can at best play a facilitating role here, an encouraging role. And one of the things we have been trying to do is encourage both sides to move forward with the dialogue. I believe to do that, they will have to set aside some of the political theology and try to focus in most immediately and most directly on the issues in which they can reach agreement, which have to do with improved trade and improved cooperation, improved business. I made a specific recommendation to them, which I've been pushing very hard, that they begin opening direct air flights between Taipei and Shanghai and Taipei and Beijing. Seems like a small thing, but it goes a long way, I think, towards bringing people closer together and helping to overcome the distrust and suspicion that is so intensive today.
This is a question which I believe sort of follows up on that. How do you reconcile the saber-rattling between China and Taiwan with the enormous flow of trade and investment between China and Taiwan? And how do those two factors interact when you look at the future of China-Taiwan relations?
I wish I had the figures firmly in my mind right now, but the direct investment of Taiwan companies on the mainland is a very large number, something like $30 or $40 or $50 billion. Therefore, Taiwan has a big stake in China, and China has a big stake in Taiwan. And that has been a tempering factor on the both sides taking rash actions, I believe. So one of the reasons that I continue, and I think the United States should continue to promote increased trade, increased investment, increased exchange, is for precisely that reason, raising the price, basically, raising the value of the two sides working together and therefore raising the price that they would have to pay if they got into a real confrontation.
There are a number of questions which deal with the risk of military conflict between China and Taiwan. Given the actual balance, military balance of forces and the role of U.S. forces in the region, do you feel that that risk of war has been somewhat overstated? How would you assess the real possibility that China and Taiwan could actually come to blows?
I do not think there's any likelihood of a military confrontation in the near future. And one of the reasons for that is that while China has today the ability to militarily harass Taiwan, they do not have the ability to conduct a successful invasion of Taiwan. And harassing Taiwan can make life very uncomfortable for the Taiwanese, it can damage their economy, but as we discussed earlier, it also damages the Chinese economy. So it's a two-edged sword. So I don't expect that to happen. In the meantime, though, the People's Liberation Army, the Chinese military forces, have put a major emphasis on building up offensive forces. I mentioned some of the examples of that, the buying of long-range aircraft from the Russians, buying aircraft carriers from the Russians, buying submarines, and building their own missiles and deploying them in very large quantities. So they are, the issue then, I think, Dan, is not whether the Chinese would be in a position to have a military confrontation today, but whether they might be 5 or 10 years from now. And they're clearly working to increase their military capabilities so that they are in that position. I do not believe that this means that the Chinese government has decided to take military action. I just think they're trying to get themselves in a stronger position so they have more leverage in dealing with Taiwan.
Again, we have a number of questions that sort of touch on what the U.S. role might be in the China-Taiwan relationship. Some of these questions, I think we can boil them down to a few. One is there a mediating role for the United States? Secondly, are there specific steps that the United States could take to make the relationship more stable, such as, one questioner asked, the suspension of arms sales from the United States to Taiwan? And finally, can you comment on the conduct from the United States' point of view of our One China policy? Have we at any point gone too far in stating our commitment to a single Chinese state?
Those are a lot of complex and deep questions. The One China is probably the essence of the issue. The American policy, One China policy, is that there is but one China, and Taiwan is a part of that China. It says nothing about what the government will be, and that's what the discussion between the two sides is to determine. It says explicitly that we are not the ones that determine how that one China is formed. That is for China and Taiwan to make that determination. We have consistently refused to play the role of a mediator in this discussion. And for that matter, neither side has requested us to be a mediator. I do not believe we'd be successful even if we were willing to do it. The question of arms sales to Taiwan, I believe as long as we see the buildup occurring from China, I think it is necessary to continue to supply Taiwan with the defensive arms. That what is needed is some creative diplomacy to try to break this, to stop this move forward, to stop this arms buildup. In a small way, I have tried to suggest this to my Chinese interlocutors by telling them that if they were to stop deploying missiles, they would declare a moratorium on missile deployment, that would probably break the impetus for supplying missile defenses. But if the missile deployments continue, then the pressure for supplying the missile defenses will be not only unbearable but reasonable. So some means have to be found for trying to stop this seemingly irresistible movement towards more and more arms being built on both sides of the strait. It's clear to me that the Chinese cannot achieve their objectives through a military solution, and it's equally clear to me that Taiwan cannot achieve its own security by simply buying more arms. A diplomatic solution is needed to this problem, and both sides have to understand that and come to grips with that reality.
Let me switch ground to Korea. A number of people wanted to know how you see the prospects for the reconciliation or even the reunification of North and South Korea, and what would be the implications of that for the United States and for the entire region.
I am optimistic that there will be a reconciliation between North and South Korea, and that reconciliation will lead to greatly increased trade, to direct investment by South Korean, Japanese, and American companies in North Korea. And by a pacification, which removes the threat of war from the Korean Peninsula. And this is an outcome devoutly to be desired. And I am optimistic that we can achieve that outcome, although not without a lot of hard work and negotiation ahead of us. Us being United States, Republic of Korea, and Japan with North Korea. And China has played an interesting and constructive role in those negotiations as well. Now, I don't see any prospect of reunification in the foreseeable future. The two countries are so far apart, so different, such their economic and social and cultural and political structures are so different that it's hard for me to imagine a reunification. So while most Koreans I talk to have in the back of their minds they would like to head to reunification, I think that is a distant goal, not a near term or even a medium term goal.
And then we have a pessimistic question on the Korean issue. What would be the options for the United States if, in case North Korea is not ready to resolve missiles and other issues of weapons of mass destruction through dialogue and through the North-South process of reconciliation?
Well, in the policy report which we submitted to the President and to Prime Minister Abuchi and to President Kim Dae-jung, we laid out a strong recommendation that it was time to break the pattern of hostility and to offer North Korea a hand of friendship and offer them a path towards normal relations. We said that a barrier to going down that path was if North Korea persisted in developing long-range missiles and nuclear weapons and threatening their neighbors with them, and that North Korea had to be prepared to give that up in a verifiable way. Now, the question is, what happens if they don't do that, in which case we cannot go down this path towards normal and friendly relations. And in the policy report which we submitted, we laid out the elements of what we called a containment policy, what we would do to contain the missiles and nuclear weapons if they had them. That part of the report is classified, and I can't describe it here. But it was it did not involve starting a war with North Korea, let me say that. It involved actions which would greatly increase the deterrence level to the North Koreans being able to use such weapons.
Today we have the news that President Putin of Russia and President Jiang Zemin of China had a meeting in Beijing, and they issued a joint statement in which they had a very strong joint opposition to the U.S. deployment of a national missile defense system and of a theater missile defense system in the area around Taiwan. Is our pursuit of missile defense bringing China and Russia together in an anti-U.S. alliance? And is that cost worth the pursuit of missile defense?
Yes, it is bringing them together. I suggested in my talk that's the cost, one of the costs that our insurance policy, and I question whether that cost is worth paying. Let me just say, though, and to give a more complete answer to the question, that I think there are a number of factors that are bringing China and Russia together. It has to do more generally with their fear that the United States has become a dominant power in the world and that they, by banding together in some way, they can resist that. I think they would have this impetus even if there were not a national missile defense program, but the national missile defense program symbolizes to them and makes an immediate and specific program around which they can focus their concern about American hegemony, as they say.
And Now, the subject of missile defense is also the subject of a number of questions from our audience, and let me see if I can sort these out into a few. There is a kind of broad question about how we should proceed on the development of missile defense. How should we handle the question of the ABM treaty with Russia, whether a decision on deployment of missile defenses would cause us to in some way abort the ABM treaty? How should we handle the negotiation with the Russians? Sort of where do we go from here?
Most people that I know, most people I talk with in this problem have passionate views about ballistic missile defenses. They're either passionately for them or passionately against them. And I confess that I don't hold either view. To me, it is a simple question of would deploying a national missile defense system increase our security or decrease our security? And I've tried to lay out the rationale today that while it quite clearly deploying it would offer you a degree of protection against a nation like North Korea getting long-range missiles and threatening us with them, that you pay a pretty high price for it, and you pay the price in international cooperation on issues that are important to our security. And ironically, that price you pay, which is failing to get the cooperation of China and Russia, could actually, in time, increase the severity of the threat to us by lowering the incentive that we have can apply to both China and Russia to cooperate with us in preventing nuclear weapons and nuclear technology and missile technology from getting in the hands of nations who might use them. So this is a fundamental question that if we do go ahead with a national missile defense system, we must understand that there is a price to be paid for it. It's not just the $60 billion cost or whatever the dollar cost is that's being advertised. It's the geopolitical cost as well. And we lump that all together, and we just have to ask ourselves, are those costs worth the very meaningful increase to our security they make by giving us a degree of protection against this threat? I have given you my own judgment on that. My own judgment is that even if these missile threats do develop, which I hope we will be able to stop, we have a considerable deterrent effect against anybody using missiles against us. Only a suicidal nation would be prepared to attack the United States with missiles and nuclear warheads. So that's a complex question. I do not have a simple answer for it. It's a matter of weighing benefits to our security versus liabilities to our security. My judgment at the present time is that I weight them in favor of trying harder to find a way of avoiding the need for deploying such a system rather than plunging ahead with the deployment. I must say that this is a position where I have worked very closely with the administration since I have left it, and have supported them in almost every position. This is a position where I have deviated from the view of the administration. And I'm hoping still that when President Clinton makes his decision about the deployment, he will decide to defer it. But I don't know yet what that decision will be. I think we will find that out in a few weeks.
Obviously, the questioner asks, a strong U.S. is essential to maintaining peace in the Asia-Pacific region. Do you think that the United States is as strong as it needs to be?
I take the question to mean strong militarily.
I took it that way.
Yeah. The United States has the strongest military force of any nation in the world today, and whoever is second is very far behind, in my opinion. I do not say this in a arm-waving, a bragging way. I'm just giving my best objective assessment of the reality. This is an opinion that's not only my opinion, it's one that was shared by virtually every one of the 67 ministers of defense I met and talked with when I was Secretary of Defense. I guess the answer to your question is yes, we do have enough military strength.
A little changing ground here, and one that speaks to your experience as well as an entrepreneur. What progress is there within China on the development of a legal system on which multinational economic growth is dependent?
One of the biggest obstacles to future economic growth in China is that they do not have such a legal system today. They understand that, and they're trying to develop such a system. I should draw a distinction here. This is a problem, by the way, in Russia as well, Russia and China. The question is, both countries understand the necessity for law and order, and both regimes are dedicated to maintaining law and order in the country. And our subtle and nuanced point to them is that the rule of law is something a step beyond that, and that requires not only a setting up the institutions, which generally do not exist in those countries today, but a point of view that a rule of law is something which is going to be beneficial not only to the people, but to the actually to the long to the stability of the governmental institutions that they have.
Well, this being the presidential season, there were a few questions along those lines. I sorted out a few of a fairly partisan nature, and I leave you with this one. What differences do you see between how the two presidential candidates would handle China-Taiwan relations?
Based on not only the view of the candidate Bush and candidate Gore, but based on the view of their advisors, as I understand them, I would say there would be very little difference in their understanding the central importance of China to long-term U.S. security and of their necessity to engage China to achieve that security, not try to achieve it through a confrontation with China. So I think both candidates would have a similar point of view about the importance of China and about the philosophical approach to China. I think one important difference would be is that in the area of national missile defenses and possibly theater missile defenses, but mostly national missile defenses, in that candidate Bush has made a very clear and unequivocal statement that he would deploy a national missile defense system, and his quibble with the present system is that it's not effective enough, that he would want a system that would be more effective than the present system. And it's quite possible, and he keeps open the possibility of going to a satellite-based system to get the kind of effectiveness you would need for a national missile defense system. That action, while he might want to regard it as something independent of the U.S.-China relations, will have a profound effect on U.S.-China relations. So I think that both candidates would approach China from the same philosophical viewpoint. The difference might be in the programmatic actions they took, particularly relative to national missile defense, which would have an unintended but very important effect on U.S.-China relations.
Now we've come to the end of our question period, and I've saved one which I think goes to the heart of how you spent a good deal of your life as a public official. Do you trust treaties?
I can't answer that one any better than President Reagan did. He said, trust but verify. And all of the treaties which we have made with Russians, with treaties and agreements that we made with the Russians, with the Chinese, with the North Koreans, have important verification features in. And the United States happily has some of the best systems operating today that allow us to verify many, if not all, of the provisions of the treaties and agreements that we make that are important to us. I think fundamentally I would say that we are not While we are the strongest military power and the strongest economic power in the world today, we cannot, do not have the ability, and we should not try to get the ability to dominate the world, to control the world, to make the world do our bidding. And therefore, we will find out that many things we want to do, many international objectives that we have, are going to require international cooperation. Some of that cooperation is with friends and allies, in NATO, for example. Others are with nations that are not allies, and we get that cooperative agreement through treaties and through agreements that are less than treaties. And so it's a very important part of functioning in the world today, and therefore the question is an important one. How do we have confidence when we make an agreement or have a treaty that's being verified and that's being carried out? And I say we have to have good verification schemes, and I think we do, but I would be willing to put even more emphasis on the techniques and systems we have which allow us to gain confidence that our treaties and agreements are in fact being followed. Thank you very much.
Our thanks to Dr. William Perry for those wise comments, and to Dan Snyder of the Mercury News. And our thanks to all of you for attending today's Commonwealth Club program. Now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley, part of the nation's largest and oldest public forum, is adjourned.